Between now and the end of June, decisions will be handed down on a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. This hour, what's at stake? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll get analysis today on the most significant cases before our nation's highest court, cases concerning affirmative action, voting rights, same-sex marriage, and the Defense of Marriage Act. Also, Michelle Bachmann says she won't seek a fifth term, and Senator Grassley of Iowa wants three seats cut from the important D.C. Circuit Appeals Court, just as President Obama prepares to announce his nominees for those jobs. Our analysts, Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Politics Wednesday starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we've arrived once again to politics. Politics Wednesday on our program today. We hope you'll join our conversation. Our analysts today, both from Drake University and both in the Department of Politics and International Relations at that university. Dennis Goldford is with us, a professor of politics, and Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of politics in our Des Moines studio. Rachel, Dennis, welcome to our program. Thank you for coming.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Many things to get to a little later in the program. As we said up front, we want to talk about some of the decisions, some of the more significant decisions we expect to be handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in the coming few weeks before the end of June. But before that, let's attend to some of the politics in the more of the breaking news. At the top of that list, Michelle Bachmann, Republican congresswoman, former presidential candidate, says she will not seek a fifth term in Congress. She made that announcement in a campaign-style video posted online, complete with an upbeat soundtrack. Also about 8 minutes of explanation and commentary in the video. Michelle Bachmann says that 8 years is long enough for a person to represent a particular congressional district. She says the decision is not about her reelection prospects or accusations of wrongdoing during her presidential campaign.
Be assured, my decision was not in any way influenced by any concerns about my being reelected to Congress. I've always in the past defeated candidates who are capable, qualified, and well-funded. And I have every confidence that if I ran, I would again defeat the individual who I defeated last year, who recently announced that he is once again running. And rest assured, this decision was not impacted in any way by the recent inquiries into the activities of my former presidential campaign or my former presidential staff. It was clearly understood that compliance with all rules and regulations was an absolute necessity for my presidential campaign, and I have no reason to believe that that was not the case.
Michelle Bachmann announcing she will not seek a fifth term in Congress. Rachel, Dennis, we have to only think, well, less than 2 years ago, she won the Iowa straw poll, was briefly regarded as a serious contender for the GOP presidential nomination. How do you interpret this decision? Dennis, to you first, perhaps.
Well, you know, Michelle Bachmann has a reputation of living in an alternate reality. So attempting to interpret this in conventional terms is very difficult. She really is not totally unique, but pretty unique in American politics, that she really does march to a beat of a different drummer. And she was considered on the endangered list, although she has a tremendous national following among Tea Party supporters and conservative evangelicals, and would have had and has always had a ton of money, and was indeed running some ads until recently about her next election. So we can wonder if, in fact, she's learned something about this particular issue that's being investigated that might be difficult for her. Ironically, this works to the detriment of Democrats, because Democrats thought they had a pretty reasonable chance of picking up a seat in a very Republican-drawn district. And I think a lot of Republicans in Minnesota and nationwide are relieved at not having to carry her, defend her, and they actually have a better chance of holding that seat in this next election.
Rachel, if it's, as Michelle Bachmann says, not about reelection prospects, not about alleged wrongdoing, what do you suppose is behind it?
Well, I think this may be a case of doth protest too much. obviously, you know, politicians decide not to run every day very few of them do it in an 8.5 video with dramatic music behind them. she hasn't ruled out a future in politics. Clearly, she's looking at options and trying to determine what's next. There's been rumors, I've heard at least two rumors of her plans for either running for the Senate seat against Al Franken and or another presidential bid.
Does she have that kind of statewide appeal to our neighbor to the north?
I can't imagine, but, you know, she surprised us in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dennis, you said a moment ago this may be have a silver lining for the GOP in regards to that specific district. But for the Tea Party wing of the GP, what are the implications there? She has been a leading spokesperson.
She has, and I wouldn't expect her to be quiet politically wherever she is or whatever she's doing. I mean, you never wanted to get between her and a microphone or a camera. She's always been able to say rather incendiary things which have bounced back and to her detriment at times. But, you know, so often in broadcast media, the more outrageous the statement, the more it's like catnip. I mean, reporters can't resist covering things like that.
So sort of taking the path that Sarah Palin has taken.
Well, I said this morning when I first saw it, I thought, well, I wouldn't be surprised to see her ending up on Fox, although Fox has shed Sarah Palin and a couple of other people lately. Maybe they're trying to be not so incendiary, but that's difficult to believe in that regard. But, no, I don't think we've seen the last of Michelle Bachmann.
Mm. I wonder if this is part of a larger trend. We saw, did we not, Jim DeMint, South Carolina, resigning from the Senate in January, now at the head of the Heritage Foundation, back in November. Florida Representative Alan West, another of that very conservative side of the Republican Party, losing in a reelection. Do you see any ties there?
I don't really. I think that those were fairly unique circumstances. I think that, in fact, with the recent coverage of what are alleged to be scandals in the Obama administration, they feed into the Tea Party narrative, the idea that government is too powerful, too aggressive. Think of the IRS issue. Think of the competence issue or the claims about that with regard to Benghazi. In fact, the number of people who say they sympathize with the Tea Party, at least according to one particular poll I saw this morning, has increased somewhat. So the Tea Party is certainly around. Alan West lost. Again, I think circumstances were unique there. He's a very bombastic guy. He had a ton of money but still lost. And Jim DeMint evidently thinks he can be more influential at the Heritage Foundation than he could in the Senate. If you look at people like Mike Lee from Utah and certainly Ted Cruz and others in the Senate, the Tea Party is still here. So I don't think that the Bachmann leaving and these others leaving means that they're gone away. They've gone away.
I do think, and I'm going to just kind of piggyback on Dennis here, I do think that one of the interesting things that some of the more prominent Tea Party representatives have shown us is that for an insurgent political movement like the Tea Party to be elected to office, you end up with a weird, a very weird disconnect between insurgent political movement and the halls of government. And I think for a number of Tea Party activists who have found themselves in this position, it's an awkward balancing act. And so perhaps they can be more influential in other positions. And or perhaps voters may get frustrated by their inability to shape the agenda as much as they had hoped.
Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford with us, Drake University's Department of Politics and International Relations.
I want to know where our music is.
if Michelle Bachmann has music, we should
have. That's right.
I'm going to sick Dennis Reese on that and see if we can find some music for you.
Great.
Do you have some inspirational words to go along with that a little later? You can choose any topic. You can talk about Cheese Whiz. I don't care. Let's talk about the D.C. Circuit Court. For the first time in 7 years, late last week, the U.S. Senate confirmed a judge to sit on this important federal appeals court for the District of Columbia. The Senate unanimously confirmed Deputy Solicitor General, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, I'm sure, Sri Srinivasan for the seat previously held, as a matter of fact, by the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. But the Federal Appeals Court for the District of Columbia still has three vacancies. President Obama apparently getting ready to nominate three justices to fill those vacancies on the D.C. Circuit Appeals Court. But wait, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley wants to prevent that by changing the size of that court and rearranging justices. Grassley is pushing a bill called the Court Efficiency Act. Let's listen to him.
The legislation is very straightforward. It would add a seat to the Second and the 11th Circuit. At the same time, it would reduce the number of authorized judgeships for the D.C. Circuit from 11 to 8.
Grassley says the court does not have enough to do. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah says that filling vacant seats on the court amounts to a political move.
I certainly hope that neither the White House nor my Democratic colleagues will instead decide to play politics and seek, without any legitimate justification, to pack the D.C. Circuit with unneeded judges simply in order to advance a partisan agenda.
Rachel Caulfield, very rarely do we have things going on these days in Washington that are not partisan. This is what is going on here?
Well, right now, the D.C. Circuit, which is widely considered to be the second highest court in the land, this is the court that considers administrative decisions coming out of Washington. So it has tremendous influence in terms of the power of government agencies and the scope of authority that those agencies take on. And right now it's balanced at 4-4, four Democrats and four Republicans. These three nominees by President Obama would potentially shift that balance very dramatically. And I think from a partisan perspective, that's one possible explanation for what's going on. Usually changes like this, particularly as they pertain to workload, would come from the Judicial Conference of the United States. The Judicial Conference recommends any sort of policy to improve the efficiency and operation of the federal courts. In this case, they have not recommended any such change. And while the D.C. Circuit Court may have a lower caseload than some other circuit courts in the country, the complexity of the cases with which they deal is so remarkably different than other circuit courts around the country. So I think, you know, there's a lot of partisanship at play. There are also some policy considerations. You know, there are a couple lines that I think are particularly important here. First of all, filling vacancies on a court is not the equivalent of court packing. Filling vacancies on federal courts is the equivalent of staffing the federal bench. And that's a big distinction. Second of all, you know, Congress, whenever they want to toy with the federal courts, they call it something like the Court Efficiency Act. So while it's, you know, clever framing of the issue, there are a number of vacancies across the federal bench that need to be filled. And Congress doesn't seem to be overly concerned about workload issues in those cases.
Dennis Goldford, how do you see it?
Well, I can't imagine. I mean, if somebody listening thinks that if the situation were reversed and you had a Republican president seeking to confronting these vacancies, if you think that person would not attempt to fill those vacancies with Republican-friendly judges, boy, do I have some land to sell you underwater somewhere, of which there's a lot here in Iowa. I mean, this is preposterous. I mean, Senator Grassley's act makes me think if a baseball game and the other team's up to bat, you all of a sudden decide that that team gets one out instead of three outs. This is changing the rules midstream. And more broadly, I've seen during the Obama administration, both the first term and this term, an attempt by Republicans to make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for Democrats to staff the administration, not just the courts. And I keep thinking there will be a Republican president at some time in the future. And what goes around comes around. And Republicans are establishing a lot of precedents for Democrats in the future in the Senate filibustering or threatening a filibuster and refusing to staff Republican vacancies.
I wonder if this proposed legislation by Senator Grassley breaks any new ground historically. We are hearing references to Roosevelt in the 1930s, are we not?
We're hearing those references. But again, you know, the federal nomination and confirmation process has always been political. It will always be political. There's no way around that. Somehow or another, we believe that this is a newly politicized thing, and it's not. You can go all the way back to Marbury versus Madison, which was fundamentally about the appointment of federal judges in a political as part of a political agenda.
But what about the enlarging or reducing in the size of the courts, the number of members?
That's always been, you know, yes. FDR tried to do it with the U.S. Supreme Court and failed. But the size of the courts is completely determined by Congress. There will always be political acts to try to, try to play with that. But for example, you know, we have vacancies in certain areas of the country. We have one vacancy in the Ninth Circuit. That seat has been vacant for 8 years. Nobody has ever proposed expanding the Ninth Circuit. They might propose splitting the Ninth Circuit for workload issues, but you end up with just a political football every time, and it just gets messier and messier.
Rachel Caulfield, Dennis Goldford of Drake University are political analysts on this Politics Wednesday. We want to leave those headline issues to the side for the moment and talk about sort of the main event that we put in this show anyway, if we can see it that way. Between now and the end of June, decisions being handed down on a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're previewing the headlines.
We are previewing the headlines. We're trying to do the crystal ball act with the headlines, perhaps. I'm not sure. Let's see what you bring to the table on these. We'll look at a few of these. These are some of the more significant court decisions we expect in the coming weeks. So I'll ask you to tell us what's at issue, the arguments likely to come, and the impact of a decision one way or another. Let's look at affirmative action, a case that's called Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin. Rachel, can you start us off and tell us what is at issue in this one?
Sure. Well, this is our case about the University of Texas's race-conscious admissions policy. The Supreme Court endorsed the idea of race-conscious admissions, or at least allowed it in Grutter versus Bollinger. And so the question at issue is whether or not those race-conscious admissions policies are essentially passé. Are they still necessary? So the University of Texas admits the top 10% of graduating seniors in the state automatically. All other students are considered by their admissions office based upon a wide range of qualifying characteristics that includes their test scores and their leadership and their community service and their work experience and their race. And the university argues that they consider race as part of a conscious effort to build diversity on their campus and that diversity improves the college experience for all students.
Mm-hmm. And the argument against that is?
Well, the argument against that is Ms. Fisher, applied and was denied admission. She claims that African-American students and other minority students who were less qualified than she was were admitted and therefore that this violated her constitutional rights to equal protection. So, you know, the degree to which the court – and I should note that the University of Texas has said that they plan to revise their admissions policy this coming year. So this may or may not have a lasting consequence. The university may just be waiting for the court's decision to determine how to revise their policy.
So you're saying it's likely they will in some form strike down the school policy?
I think – you know, most experts right now are looking at Justice Kennedy as the swing vote and expect a fairly limited ruling that would demand some sort of change in the current practice. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting that the court has accepted for review a case out of Michigan that it's a voter-approved ban on all affirmative action policies. And so the court will be considering that in its next term.
Any implications for colleges, universities here in Iowa, across the country?
Well, I think that there are, you know, potential implications for any public university in particular who, their admissions office is very closely considering how to create the best educational experience for their students. And, you know, for those who believe that a diversity of race and a diversity of perspectives is vital to that effort, then, yeah, there are implications in crafting those admissions policies all across the country.
Dennis. Historically, the basic idea in a way, goes back to the Bakke decision in the 1970s, in which Justice Powell said that involved University of California, that university could not use quotas based on race, but they could take race into account. And the reason for that was the idea that really until the 1960s, at least if not continuing, race was always taken into account in favor of whites and against non-whites. Race was always taken into account. And with the various civil rights acts, the idea was at least that race shouldn't be a factor, but the idea was that because that account taking account of race in favor of whites dug such a deep hole for non-whites, that there needed to be, at least for a while, and that was the big question, how long, some sort of affirmative action to balance things out, to help dig out of that hole. In one of the Michigan cases, may have been Grutter, I can't remember, or Bollinger, Justice O'Connor said that she thought, well, maybe in 25 years.
Right.
Now, she pulled this number who knows where out of her hat. We could stop being considering matters like this. But the liberal view now tends to be that affirmative action is a proper tool for increasing diversity, increasing representation of non-whites in all areas of American life. The conservative view, which 50 years ago was in favor of discriminating on the basis of whites, now the conservative view is race shouldn't be a factor at all, and that's the position that Ms. Fisher is taking.
Dennis Goldford, Rachel Caulfield, we have about 3 minutes before we take a short break. I wonder if in that time we can have you tell us what's at stake in this Supreme Court case involving voting rights.
That's really interesting.
It is.
It's very interesting. One of the things that occurred with the civil rights laws in the 1960s was that states with some sort of history of discrimination – now, it turned out to be not all states. They're predominantly southern states for obvious reasons.
Plus Alaska.
I was going to say Alaska and I believe maybe California. I can't remember. But with this history in which non-whites just did not vote at the same levels and did not have the same level of success or anywhere near it in electing officials who were non-white or sympathetic to non-white concerns – states, anytime they altered their election laws or voting procedures, they had to clear it with the federal government. We've banned literacy tests. I mean, literacy tests used to be, if you remember, Dick, Jane, and Sally. See Dick, see Jane, see Spot, chase Sally. That's the kind of literacy test whites were given in the South. In non-whites were given just the incredibly complex pieces of text that probably I couldn't read at this point. So it was used in a very discriminatory manner. So the idea behind this pre-clearance method imposed by the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, was that states with a history of discrimination had to clear with the federal government any kind of changes they made in their voting procedures and voting laws, including districting. And I know we're getting close to a break.
Right. And depending on how the court hands the decision down, this provision may go away, that the states do not have to check beforehand, right?
Well, Justice Roberts has said that the black participation has achieved parity with white participation, but there's some issues in Texas we can perhaps talk about after the break regarding the way redistricting is used, and there have been an interesting confluence of interest between black elected officials and the Republican Party in the way this redistricting has been done based upon this consideration.
Okay. Dennis Goldford with us, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, taking us through a Politics Wednesday that is centered on the courts, actually, looking at some of the upcoming decisions to be handed down by the Supreme Court in the coming weeks. When we come back, we'll look at finish up with voting rights and then take a look at two decisions to be handed down on separate issues involving same-sex marriage. And we hope you'll join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. It's River to River Politics Day with Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield, back in just a few minutes. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in April, President Obama unveiled an expansive research initiative. It intended to redefine how we understand the human brain. With that in mind, and as a backdrop, we're going to focus on brain trauma tomorrow at this time. My guest, Daniel Trunell, professor of neurology and psychology at the University of Iowa, also the current director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry. We'll also talk tomorrow with a brain trauma survivor. Brain science tomorrow on the program. Today, Politics Wednesday. And in this part of the program, we're talking about the Supreme Court with Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. Between now and the end of June, decisions being handed down on a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. We're looking at what's at issue, on the likely outcome, the impact of these. And when we left off, before we get to our two cases that look at same-sex marriage, let's finish up with voting rights as the issue in this case, Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder. At issue, the continued use of the federal government of the key enforcement provision of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. And Dennis, you wanted to add something to this to see if we are past the point where these certain states, primarily southern states, need to check with the federal government before they do things like redistricting, right?
Yeah, well, the southern states have always thought that this is an imposition on them, an insult to their sovereignty. Some of them, you know, are still fighting or litigating the Civil War in some way. But I think that, Justice Roberts mentioned in a recent case that we have increased turnout among non-whites, at least at certain levels, in regard to the vote, depending upon the type of election it is. And I've seen some figures, although I've seen some questions about whether they're accurate, that black turnout in 2012 was actually greater than white turnout. Be that as it may, you can argue that, yes, African Americans and Hispanic Americans, others, are voting at increasingly higher rates. Whites are becoming a smaller percentage of the overall electorate in particular elections. But this law still applies to questions of redistricting. And in Texas, for example, a huge amount, and I think, in fact, there was an NPR story on that this morning, a huge amount of the Texas increase in population has been among Hispanics. And yet with the increased number of seats, they're alleging those seats have been used to increase white power, Anglo power in Texas.
Through gerrymandering.
Right, right. There's something called cracking and packing in gerrymandering. And, of course, we get this term gerrymandering from Elbridge Gerry, one of the people at the Constitutional Convention. And when they drew his congressional district, people said it looked like a salamander. And that's where we got the term gerrymander, now gerrymander. But in packing a district, you want to put as many people of one party in a district and keep the people of the other party out of that district. And in cracking, you want to bleach it out, so to speak. You want as few people of a particular party in a district. And what's happened really with the way states have drawn boundaries, especially in the South, is that they've packed a certain number, a small number of districts to maximize African-American population in that district, increase presumably the number of African-American representatives and congressmen that might be elected. But what that's done is decrease the number of African-American voters in most other districts. And since they tend to vote Democratic, that's made these other districts more safely Republican. So more African-American legislators have been elected, particularly in the South. But again, that's this strange alliance between them and the Republican Party that's made all the other districts a lot more Republican than they would otherwise have been.
Does this court look likely to strike down or somehow gut the Section 5? Will it impact next year's midterm elections, for instance?
Well, that's the critical question. As Dennis said earlier, John Roberts has indicated that he believes that it may be time for this critical provision within the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, to be nullified, to move on, and to recognize how much the country has changed since it was initially enacted. It's important to realize that Section 5, which is the key piece that's at issue in the case, was actually reauthorized in 2006. So it's, you know, we think of this as kind of a holdout from the 1960s and the original Voting Rights Act. But in fact, it's been, you know, reconfirmed by Congress, you know, within the past, well, let's be precise, 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
But hasn't Justice Scalia, who supposedly is supposed to be deferential toward other branches
sure.
of government, has said, oh, they're all afraid to vote against
sure.
it.
Yeah.
He's made comments to that effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And its effect on midterm elections, if it is struck down?
Well, we have, you know, in most states, we have newly redrawn congressional districts, and so all of them could potentially and state legislative districts, all of them could potentially be affected or particularly in these states that are covered by Section 5, could potentially be affected. And we could see some redrawing of district boundaries pretty quickly, which would certainly affect midterm elections.
Rachel Caulfield with us, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our political analysts this Politics Wednesday. Let's move on to two cases involving same-sex marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court, expecting decisions on those in the coming weeks. We have one that concerns the Defense of Marriage Act, Windsor v. U.S., and that California ballot measure, Proposition 8, Hollingsworth v. Perry. I wonder if we can start with the Defense of Marriage Act. Tell us what's at issue there. Who would like to jump in?
Well, so Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act in the mid-90s, and the goal was to define, for federal purposes, to define marriage as between one man and one woman. Edie Windsor is 84 years old. She and her partner were married in Canada and subsequently lived in New York. Her partner passed away, and Edie Windsor had a $363,000 estate tax debt to pay after her partner's death. She is suing, and she's bringing this case to the Supreme Court on the basic premise that had she been legally married to a man in a marriage recognized by the state of New York, as her marriage to her partner was recognized in the state of New York, then she would not have had to pay that estate tax. So there's this component of the Defense of Marriage Act. Really, the only provision of the Defense of Marriage Act that is directly considered by the case is a provision regarding benefits. And so she's claiming Fifth Amendment due process, violation of her due process rights. And there's several really interesting turns and twists in this case. For example, the Obama administration declined to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. Typically, this is a federal law, and therefore the Solicitor General would be defending the law. In this case, the Solicitor General is not defending the law, and instead a group of Republican members of the House of Representatives are bringing the appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Interestingly, however, the Obama administration does enforce the law. So while they are implementing the law actively, they will not defend the law. And this actually came up in oral arguments. Some of the justices said, you know, this case would be a lot easier if the Obama administration simply didn't enforce it. What that would do is it automatically give Congress and members of Congress the legal right to bring the lawsuit and to claim that the Obama administration has to enforce it. As it is, there's a question about whether or not the law can be and should be defended by members of Congress without the administration. So there's in the legal world, this is called the standing issue. Do they have standing?
Outside of this one case, depending on what's decided, what could be the impact, the implications of the decision?
Oh, my. Well, if this is overturned, you know, there's enough opposition to same-sex marriage that I don't know how overturning the benefits issue would have even more of an impact. But there's another side of the case that, as I understand it, it's another side of the law that, as I understand it, is not part of the case, which would have greater impact. And the law, I believe, says, and this, I believe, Rachel, has not really been litigated here, the full faith and credit issue,
right,
that the law says that states that don't recognize same-sex marriages don't have to recognize a same-sex marriage performed from another state. This has to do with what's called the full faith and credit clause of Article 4 of the Constitution. If you get married, you live in Pennsylvania and you get married and you move to Iowa, typically Iowa will recognize that marriage and vice versa. The law says, well, when it comes to same-sex marriage, if you were married in a same-sex marriage state and you move to a state that doesn't recognize it, that state can't be forced to recognize it. That runs right up against the full faith and credit clause of Article 4. That's not being litigated here. That would have a huge issue, because right now, if it's overturned, that simply means that in the states that do recognize same-sex marriage, the federal government would have to accede to that definition and provide benefits. This other issue of full faith and credit would mean that if Mississippi doesn't want to have same-sex marriage, but somebody married in a same-sex relationship in Iowa or New York or somewhere moves to Mississippi, then Mississippi would have to recognize that. That would be huge, and the pushback would be intense.
I think it's
fair to say that we're going to get as narrow a ruling as possible in this case. The court does not appear eager to step out and make a big, broad ruling on same-sex marriage here, or even, quite frankly, on the rights of the LGBT population.
So if a ruling is a pebble, it will be the smallest possible pebble to throw
into
the pond.
Yep. They'll try.
Okay, let's see. How does this relate to the California ballot measure, Proposition 8, also before the Supreme Court? I understand at issue whether the Constitution's 14th Amendment, this guarantee of equal protection, prevents states from defining marriage as being between only one man and one woman. Tell us about this one.
Right. So in 2008, the voters of California approved Proposition 8 with 52% of the vote, and Proposition 8 limited the definition of marriage to an institution that exists only between one man and one woman. An appeals court in San Francisco ruled that proposition unconstitutional after it had already passed. The Supreme Court has accepted this case, and the question is whether or not Proposition 8 fundamentally infringes upon the 14th Amendment rights of Californians. Again, I don't think the court is particularly eager or willing to step forward and federalize any sort of right to marriage for the LGBT community. I think what's most likely in this case, again, we have a really interesting standing issue in this case because the state of California refused to defend Proposition 8. And so the people who have brought this lawsuit are a collection of groups that advocated in favor of Proposition 8 during the campaign. And a good portion of the oral argument at the Supreme Court really paid exclusive attention to the question of whether or not these groups have a legal right to bring this lawsuit. And so I think most people right now expect that the court will likely dig the case. And what that means is they dismiss as improvidently granted. So they decide for whatever reason that although they granted review, that perhaps they shouldn't have done that. If they reach a decision in the case itself, I think it's expected to be as narrow as it could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. Why does the court, it seems, well, just by the court tends to or wants to be narrow in its decision. Is that a tendency of this court or all courts, all high courts?
No, not all high courts. Justice Roberts seems to want to make things as narrow as possible. He'd like greater unanimity in decisions. When I teach my seminar in constitutional law, we'll read a lot of 5-4 cases. And students will read the majority opinion or opinions and find them interesting perhaps or compelling. But then they'll read all these dissents but they know that all it takes is one vote to flip it back the other way. And that seems to undermine the authority of the court, at least the way the public understands the court. So Justice Roberts wants to have as consensual a court as possible. He has as many unanimous decisions as possible. But there's still a strong conservative block on that court of Alito, Thomas, Roberts, and Scalia. And Justice Kennedy is your mover in there. Then there's more liberal block with the others. And Justice Kennedy seems to be the swing vote so often. So people ask, is this a Roberts court or is this a Kennedy's court? Well, a Kennedy court, but Roberts wants to make it his court. The court tends to find itself on safer ground politically when they issue a narrow ruling.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, Rachel Caulfield, we want to take a few minutes to dive back into some other politics of the week, if we could, in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes we have here. Let's talk about immigration quickly. A bill proposed by the bipartisan Gang of Eight to revamp the nation's immigration rules passed out of committee last week, soon to be brought to the Democratic-led Senate. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he's ready to see something happen.
So I'm going to do nothing to interfere with immigration. It is important for our country, and I admire the bipartisan nature of what happened with the Gang of Eight. It's exemplary what we should do around here on everything.
Okay, but it's unclear what might happen in the Republican-led House, where Speaker Boehner says they will not just take whatever comes out of the Senate or anywhere else.
The House is going to work its will, on immigration. We're not going to be stampeded by the White House or stampeded by the president. The Senate is working its will. A lot of good work that's gone on over there. But the House will work its will. Don't ask me how, because if I knew, I'd certainly tell you.
Dennis Goldford, what's going on? Will we definitely have comprehensive immigration reform?
No, nothing's ever definite with this Congress.
This is the U.S. Congress.
Right. You know, there's a strong segment of the Republican Party. It's hard to say what percentage, but certainly an extremely intense element of the Republican Party who simply says they broke the law. That's the beginning and the end of it. And they should not be rewarded for breaking the law, people who are in the country illegally. Now, you have people like John McCain who will say and others will say, no, we're not going to get the military and throw these people physically out of the country. If there are that many, it's simply not feasible. So you've got some attempt to deal with this problem in a way that will solve it, decrease the number of illegals without saying, hey, look, if you stay long enough, they'll finally get to the point in which they will legalize you. So nobody wants to reward illegal behavior. They want to punish it, but there are limits on how they punish it. But at the same time, you've got strong Republican voices who see anything in this direction as legalizing or rewarding illegal behavior. On the other hand, you've got Republican political operatives who say you've got a growing Hispanic population in this country, and if we're going to get killed at the polls if we alienate them further, and they're the ones who are more inclined to say we've got to find some humane way of dealing with this problem.
Is there a common ground on immigration? What does it look like?
I think the true answer to that is we don't know yet.
Okay.
We know what the Gang of Eight in the Senate has been able to put forward, a path to citizenship. The House, it appears to be unclear what sorts of agreements we may be able to come to in the House. And, for those people who don't pay attention to kind of the inner workings of Congress, the House is a far more partisan institution. It is designed to be a more partisan institution. The Speaker of the House, if you have the Speaker of the House saying, I really don't know what this is going to look like, it's a clear indication that we really don't know what this is going to look like, because the Speaker of the House yields an amazing amount of power in that institution.
Mario Rubio, Senator Rubio, has been the poster boy for Republican outreach toward Hispanics in the country. And again, that's a term that includes Cuban Americans, Mexican Americans, Puerto Rican Americans, and then not all the same in their voting behavior. But a lot of these other Republican hardliners, despite the fact that Rubio's been the poster boy for Republican outreach, they've been cutting the ground out from underneath him.
Right. And it seems Iowa's Steve King, Congressman Steve King, has made remarks in the last few days about Marco Rubio, saying that his stance on immigration will essentially eliminate him during the Iowa caucuses, has he not?
Yeah, I believe so. Well, Senator King has ridden this horse for a long time. I think moderating a debate between him and a Democrat, I can't recall at the moment, in the early to mid-90s over a law in Iowa about official English. So he's been concerned about this kind of issue and related issues for a long, long time.
We heard also in the news very quickly before we have to go, Iowa State Senator Jack Hatch preparing to campaign for the governor's office this morning, saying at a news conference that he'll be traveling the state and fundraising. And if that certain funding level reaches a certain level, he'll run. He had criticism for current governor, Republican Terry Branstad. One topic was about the governor's economic development policies.
He is chasing the old strategy of giving tax breaks to large corporations. And what he's doing is doing nothing more than expanding the corporation. He is not creating jobs. You see that all too well with Orascom fertilizer plant, where he spent $110 million of Iowa taxpayers' money for 165 jobs. That comes out to a little more than $637,000 per job.
Jack Hatch says he'll step aside if former governors Tom Vilsack or Chet Culver decide to run. But generally, in the final minute of our program, what challenges face the Democrats in taking back the Iowa governorship?
Well, I think, first of all, that Terry Branstad has never lost a race for governor. He's always been tremendously successful in this regard. He's had good support among independent voters, the single biggest voting bloc in the state. So he's known statewide. Boy, if there's anybody known in this state other than Bob Ray, it's Terry Branstad. And Jack Hatch still would have to make himself known. But I think, second, part of the problem for any Democrat in 2014 is that you're going to have a more Republican electorate. Voting participation goes down all across the board between the parties from a presidential year to a midterm year, but it goes down more for Democrats. So the electorate in 2014 is likely to be like 2010, wider, older, more conservative, more Republican. And any Democrat's going to have to fight against that really hard.
Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics, Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Rachel, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us this hour with your insights. It's been a real pleasure.
It has been.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, I hope you'll tune in. We'll talk with a brain trauma survivor, also a brain scientist, Daniel Trunell, Professor of Neurology and Psychology, also current director of the Iowa Neurological Patient Registry at the University of Iowa, will be on our program talking brain science. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines today, help from John Pemble, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.